Okay, so our last talk in this room for the day, last but definitely not least, the moral value of information. When faced with ethical decisions, we generally prefer to act on more evidence rather than less. If the expected value of two options available to us are similar, but the expected value of one option is based on more evidence than the other is, then we generally prefer the option that has more evidential support. In this talk, our next speaker, Amanda Askell, argues that although we are intuitively disinclined to favor interventions with poor evidential support, there are reasons for thinking that these are sometimes better than favoring interventions with a proven track record. Amanda is a final year PhD student in philosophy at NYU, where she works on infinite population ethics. Her primary research interests are in ethics, decision theory, and epistemic rationality. She has completed a BPhil in philosophy at the University of Oxford and has written articles for Vox, The Guardian, and Quartz. Please welcome Amanda to the stage.
Hello, everyone. Okay, so I'm going to start the talk with some spoilers. Basically, I want nothing here to be a surprise. So the first thing that I'm kind of going to claim, and I hope you find it plausible, is that we generally prefer interventions with more evidential support, all else being equal. And I'll kind of go into detail about what that means. The second is I'm going to argue that having less evidence in favor of a given intervention means that your credences about the effectiveness of that intervention are what I call like lower resilience. This is something that's been explored in decision theory to some extent. And that's true even if your credences about the effectiveness of that intervention are the same value. You know, so if I thought there was a 50% chance that I would get $100, there's actually a difference between a low resilience 50% and a high resilience 50%. I'm going to argue that if your credences are lower resilience, then the value of information in this domain is generally higher than it would be in a domain where your credences are high resilience. And I'm going to argue that this means that actually, in many cases, we should prefer interventions with less evidential support, all else being equal. So hopefully you find that counterintuitive and interesting. So the first thing to say is that we generally think that expected value calculations are a pretty decent way of estimating the effectiveness of a given intervention. So an example here is one where we imagine that there is a disease A, very novelly and interestingly named, and another disease, equally interestingly named, disease B. And basically, the idea is that these two diseases are virtually impossible to differentiate. You know, they all have the same symptoms, they cause the same like reduction in life expectancy, etc. The key difference is that they respond very differently to different treatments. So any doctor who finds themselves with a patient with one of these conditions is in a difficult situation. So they can prescribe drug A. Drug A costs $100. If the patient has disease A, then drug A will basically extend their life by another 10 years. If, on the other hand, they have disease B, it won't extend their life at all. They will die of disease B because disease B is completely non-responsive to drug A. So the expected years of life that we get from drug A is 0.05 per dollar. Drug B works in a very similar way, except is used to treat drug disease B. If you have disease A, it will be completely non-responsive, so it's got the same expected value. And then we have drug C. So drug C costs $100, but regardless of whether you have disease A or disease B, it will in fact be responsive to drug C. So this is like a new and interesting drug. And this means that the expected value for drug C is greater than the expected value for either drug A or drug B. So we think, okay, great, kind of obvious that you should prescribe drug C. But suppose that drug A and drug B have been heavily tested in numerous trials, and they've been shown in meta-analyses to be highly effective, and that the estimates that I just gave you were extremely robust. Drug C, on the other hand, is completely new. It's only gone a single trial in which it increased patients' lives by many years. And so you have a conservative prior about the effectiveness of a drug. You think, in all likelihood, most random drugs that we were to select would either be net neutral or net negative. So that's your conservative prior. And so if you see one trial in which a drug massively extends someone's life, then your prior might bring you down to something like 6 years, regardless of whether they have disease A or disease B, if we assume that in the trial, this was a trial of patients with both diseases. So we have the same expectation, but suddenly it seems a bit more questionable about whether we should prescribe drug C. So this kind of idea that we should favor interventions with more evidence, and that it's a kind of failing of expected utility theory, that it can't capture this, or expected value calculations that it can't capture this, is kind of summed up in this blog post from GiveWell, I think from a couple of years ago. There seems to be nothing in explicit expected value that penalizes relative ignorance or relatively poorly grounded estimates. If I can literally save a child I see drowning by ruining a $1,000 suit, but in the same moment I make a wild guess that this $1,000 could save two lives if I put it towards medical research, then explicit expected value seems to indicate that I should opt for the latter. So the idea is there's something wrong with expected value calculations because they kind of tell us to take wild guesses as long as the expected value is higher. So I want to argue that there are kind of two claims that we might want to vindicate in these sorts of cases. The first claim is one that I think I and hopefully you find quite plausible. It's the claim that evidence matters. So how much evidence we have about an intervention can make a difference to what we should do. The second claim is the one that I think is kind of implied by the previous quote, which is that we should favor more evidence, all else being equal. So favor more evidence says, if the expected value of two interventions is similar, we should generally favor investing in interventions that have more evidence supporting them. So in a case involving drug A and drug B and drug C, maybe we would say something like these are relevantly similar. And so in a case where you have a lot of evidence that drug A and drug B have the kind of effects that you saw, this might actually favor giving a kind of more well-known drug over a new one that's only been shown in one trial to be effective. So I'm basically going to consider both of these claims and whether expected value calculations can vindicate either or both of them. As you kind of know from the spoilers, I'm going to argue that it can support the first claim, but that it actually rejects the second. Okay, so I want to turn to this notion of resilience and how we represent how much evidence you have in terms of the credences that you assign to propositions like this drug will cure this disease. And so take the first case, which is this untested coin. So I've given you no information about how biased this coin is. It could be completely biased in favor of heads. It could be completely biased in favor of tails, or it could be a completely fair coin. And you have like no information to distinguish between any of these hypotheses. It seems like in a case where you have a completely, when you have no idea about what the bias of a coin is, and I say to you, what is the chance that it lands heads on the next throw? You're going to have to say it's about 50%, because you have no reason to favor a heads bias over a tails bias. But now consider a different case, which is the well-tested coin. So the well-tested coin, you flip it, you get the following sequence, heads, 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 tails, heads, heads, tails, tails, until the coin has been flipped a million times. You had a very, very boring series of days with this coin. So the difference in these cases, in the first case, it seems like in answer to the question, what's the probability that the coin will land heads on the next flip, you should say 0.5 or 50%. In the second case, where you've tested the coin a bunch and it's come up heads roughly 50% of the time, tails roughly 50% of the time, you should also say that the next flip is likely to be heads. So this is reflected in the resilience levels of your credences. So one kind of simple formulation of resilience, I think we can get a bit more specific with this, but for the purposes of this talk, it doesn't matter too much, is that credal resilience is how stable you expect your credences to be in response to new evidence. So if my credences are high resilience, then there's more stability. I basically don't expect them to vary that much as new evidence comes in, even if the evidence is good and is like pertinent to the question. If they're low resilience, then they have like low stability. I expect them to change a lot in response to new evidence. And that's true in the case of the untested coin, where I just have no data about how good it is, and so the resilience of my credence of 50% is fairly low. It's worth noting that resilience levels can be reflected, can reflect either like the set of evidence that you have about a proposition or your prior about that proposition. So if you, if it's just incredibly plausible that coins are generally fair. So for example, if you saw me simply pick the coin up out of a stack of like otherwise fair coins, I mean, in this case, you'd have like evidence that it's fair. But if you simply live in a world that doesn't include a lot of very biased coins, then your prior might be doing a lot of the work that your evidence would otherwise do. So these are the two things that kind of generate credo resilience. So in both cases, with the coin, your credence that you that the coin will land heads on the next flip is the same. It's 0.5. And your credence of 0.5 about the tested coin is resilient because you've done like a million trials of this coin. Whereas your credence about the untested coin is fairly fragile. It could easily move in response to new evidence, as we see here. So take this third case. You start to test the untested coin. So you perform a series of flips of the coin, and you start to see a pattern. In a case like this, it looks like the coin in front of you is pretty heavily heads biased, or you at least start to like quite rapidly increase your credence that it's heads biased. And so your credence that it's going to come up heads next time is much higher. Because you had less evidence before, this credence was like much more fragile, and so now you've seen a change. This would not happen if you got this sequence on the well-tested coin, because more evidence means that your credences are more resilient. If you saw a series of five heads after performing a million trials and it lands heads roughly half the time, this is just not going to make a huge difference to what you expect the next coin flip to come up. I actually think that, like, to kind of go off the slides a little bit, I think credo resilience has some kind of interesting effects. So a lot of people seem to think that, be kind of unwilling to assert probability estimates about whether something's going to work or not. And I think a really good explanation for this is that in cases where we don't have a lot of evidence, our credences about how good our credences are fairly low. So our credences that, we basically think it's really likely that we're going to move around a lot in response to new evidence. And when that's the case, we're just not willing to assert a credence that's we just think is going to be false or inaccurate once we gain a little bit more evidence. So sometimes people think that you have like mushy credences, that you don't actually have precise probabilities that you can assign to claims like this intervention is effective to degree n. I actually think resilience might be a good way of explaining that away and to say, no, you can have like really precise estimates. You just aren't willing to assert them. So one thing that this has a huge influence on, and is the kind of theme of this talk, I suppose, is the value of information. So to return to our drug case, which I hope you'll see is kind of, the idea is that this is supposed to be somewhat analogous to interventions, but I don't want to like put any interventions there because I don't want to make people think that I think that their interventions don't have enough evidence behind them. So in the original case, we had the following kind of scenario where we had expected 0.05, 0.05, and 0.06 for the three drugs. Of course, one thing that we can do here is we can gain valuable evidence about the world. So consider this case where diagnosis basically is invented, and so at least as far as disease A and disease B are concerned. And so we can now diagnose whether you have disease A or disease B. And it costs $60 additional to do so. Given this, if I diagnose you, then I can expect that conditional on diagnosis, if you have disease A, you will live for 10 years because I'll be able to then pay an additional $100 to give you drug A. And if you have disease B, I'll be able to pay an additional $100 to get you drug B. And so in this case, the value of diagnosis is higher than the value of, including the cost of then curing you of the disease, is actually higher than any of the original interventions. So rather than giving you drug A, drug B, drug C, I should diagnose you and then give you the correct drug. So hopefully this is intuitive. I also hope these slides are correct because I am the Ron Burgundy of presenters, and so I will just read anything that's on my slides, which can be very bad. Okay, I shouldn't give people that information. okay, so here's like a different way that information can be valuable. So that was kind of information about the world, which maybe we think is valuable anyway. You know, so if I find out that, like, suppose that I care about global poverty and I want to find out about good interventions, I can find out about, like, deficiencies that exist in India, for example, and then I can see if there are good ways to, like, improve that. So that's finding out about the world. But obviously a different way that we can gain valuable information here is by finding out information about interventions themselves. So an example here would be to look at the actual intervention of drug C and to look at how effective it is. So suppose that the cost of a trial of drug C that would bring you to basically certainty about its effectiveness is, in this wonderfully ideal world, $5,000. And you have a credence of about 0.5 that it's going to come out that in both disease A and disease B, this only actually extends life by 2 years. So let that be the kind of skeptical prior represented. This is obviously extremely idealized. Somehow you know that it can only be very low impact or very high impact. But you also have a credence of about 0.5 that it'll extend life by 10 years in both cases. Okay, so you're currently prescribing drug C. You're actually being kind of, you're ignoring the fact that there's low evidence here. You obviously don't exist in any modern medical system. Your credence, so you're going with the expected value as is, basically. And then the question is, what is the value of doing this trial? Especially given that you're already prescribing drug C. So if your credence in low impact goes to 1, i.e. you suddenly discover that this drug is much less effective than you thought it would be, then you're going to switch from drug C to prescribing drug A or B again. Let's assume diagnosis has kind of gone out of the window. So the per-patient benefit is going to be from 2 years of expected life to 5 years of expected life in this case. And that's because if you've been prescribing drug C and it actually does only have a two-year life benefit, then, you know, you're... this is not great. Whereas if you discover that drug C is effective, in fact, I think this I've got this in the next slide. So you can see here that if you perform no trial, you won't spend anything, but you'll only get 2 years of additional life per $100. In fact, if it is in fact a low impact drug. Because you'll be prescribing drug C continuously every time you see disease A and disease B, and it's only giving people 2 years of additional life. Whereas if it's high impact, then you're going to start prescribing, you'll still get the 10-year benefit because you'll have been accidentally prescribing something that's very good. If you perform a trial, then you spend $5,000, but you realize that drug C is pretty bad, and so you start prescribing drug A and drug B again. And once again, you get an expected benefit of 5 years instead of 2. Whereas if it's high impact, okay, you found that out and you continue to prescribe drug C. So the trial adds 1.5 years of expected life per future treatment. The trial is therefore better than prescribing drug C if there are more than 2,000 patients. So if there are more than 2,000 patients, the value of investing in a trial of drug C is better than giving any of the drugs directly at present, i.e. the information value actually swamps the direct value of intervention here. The value of investing in drug A or B testing is going to be negligible because our credences about its effectiveness are already resilient. So I think that this is all to kind of build up to what I think is the sort of result of this, which is a fairly intuitive one really, is that actually expected utility theory or expected value calculations might say that in cases where all else is equal, we should favor investing in interventions that have less evidence rather than interventions that have more. So here I put this as if the expected concrete value of two interventions is similar, we should generally favor investing in interventions that have less evidence supporting them. I'm going to use like concrete value to just mean non-informational value. And the idea here is that in such cases, the concrete value is the same, but the information value for one of them is much higher, namely the one that you have a much lower resilience credence generating your expected value calculation. Cool. Okay, so this gets us to the kind of like, what does this mean and what should we do part. So I hope I've kind of convinced you that despite the fact that this was a kind of intuitive proposition that we should favor things with more evidence, there's actually some argument that we should favor things that have less evidence. So when we're considering information value, there are basically three options available to us. I used to call this look, leap, and retreat, and then I discovered, you know, I really like things that sound the same. So I went for explore, exploit, or evade, because it's much more standard terminology. So we can choose to explore, and this means investing resources in intervention for its information value primarily. So things like research, funding to gather data, career trials. We can exploit, which means investing resources in an intervention for its concrete value. So that means things like large project grants and entire career choices. Or we can evade. We can decide just not to invest in a given intervention. We either invest elsewhere or we completely delay investment. The main difference between these is the reason for action. So take three people. Amy donates $100 to an existential risk charity to protect the future of humanity. So she's just exploiting the value. She's just looking at the direct concrete value of this intervention. Bella donates $100 to the same charity to find out how much good they can do in the world. So she's doing it mainly to explore, and then later she'll exploit. She'll think to herself, okay, let's see how valuable this is. If it's very valuable, then she'll basically mine the value of that. Carla donates $100 to charity C so that we have more time to discover what the best causes are. So she is exploiting currently by investing in it for its direct existential value for reducing existential risk so that we can find out what the best cause is so that we can exploit that. So she's exploiting to explore to exploit. So when is exploring especially cost-effective? Essentially, when there's three kind of features. When there's more uncertainty about the direct value of an intervention, so this means options that have high expected value but low resilience. When there are high benefits of certainty about the direct value, so this is like when we can basically repeatedly mine something for value, and when there are low information costs, so when information is either not too costly to obtain and delay is low cost. You don't really want to be looking for information, you know, if a car is like driving towards you, the cost of not just taking action of getting out of the way is pretty high. The question I have is, basically, is gaining information especially valuable for effective altruists? Maybe a different way to put this is information essentially its own cause area within effective altruism? So there's a lot of uncertainty within and across good cause areas, especially if we consider things like long-term indirect effects. We don't know about the long-term indirect effects of a lot of our interventions. So I think that it certainly satisfies the lot, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty here. We see that in terms of seeing the progress that EA research has made. I think this is evidence of a lot of uncertainty. There are also like high benefits of certainty in this case. We expect to use this information in the long term. Effective altruism isn't like a short-term intervention. So in multi-generational projects, you expect the value of information to be higher because people can essentially explore for longer and basically find optimal interventions. And to some degree, there are low information costs insofar as the movement is young and there's still a lot of low-hanging fruit. With caveats, maybe you're a bit like Carla. Maybe you're very worried that like we're just like screwing up the climate or that nuclear war is going to, you know, go terribly wrong, in which case maybe you just think we should just be directly intervening in those areas, even if we, you know, for information value, if you like. So what difference would exploring more make to effective altruism if you kind of buy my argument that this is an important cause area? Well, I think we'd probably invest a lot more time and resources in interventions that are plausibly good in order to gain evidence about them. I think we'd probably do more research, but I realize that this point is kind of self-serving. I think that large donors would probably diversify their giving more if the value of information diminishes steeply enough, which I think might be the case. Psychologically, I think we'd be a bit more resilient to failure and change. I think people find the idea that they might be giving to cause areas that could turn out to just be completely fruitless. They find it kind of psychologically difficult. In some ways, just thinking, look, I'm just exploring this to get the information about how good it is, and if it's bad, I'll just change. Or if it doesn't do as well as I thought, I'll just change. I actually find this like quite psychologically comforting if, like me, you worry about these things. Okay. So the extreme view that you could have is we should just start investing time and money in interventions with high expected value but little or no evidential support. A more modest proposal, which is the one that I'm going to kind of endorse, is We should probably start explicitly including the value of information in assessments of causes and interventions, rather than treating it as like an afterthought to concrete value. In some of the things that I've looked at, I really think information value can swamp concrete value. And if that's the case, then it really shouldn't be an afterthought. It shouldn't be that one of the primary drivers of value is like an afterthought in your calculation. Summary. Evidence does make a difference to expected value calculations via the value of information. If the expected concrete value to interventions is the same, this will favor testing out the intervention with less evidential support rather than one with more. And taking value of information seriously would change what effective altruists invest their resources, i.e. their time and money in. The end.
I like a researcher recommending we should do research. So one person did have a question about what it means to have credence in a credence, right? Maybe 80% chance that it, you know, a 50% chance of it working, et cetera, et cetera. Does it recurse down to zero, was the person's question.
Yeah, so it's not that you have a credence that you have a credence, but your credence in your credence being the same or changing in response to new evidence. There are kind of like a lot of related concepts here. There are things like your credence about the accuracy of your credence. So it's not something like, oh, I have a credence that I have a credence of 0.8. I think you also have those, but this is a separate thing, which is like my credence that in response to this trial, I will adjust my credence from 0.5 to either 0.7 or 0.2 is the kind of credence that I'm talking about.
Do you think there's a way to avoid falling into the rabbit hole of the like nesting credences of the kind that the person might have been referring to?
Oh, like I have a credence that I have a... I assume that... So I guess my view in the boring philosophical jargon is that credences are dispositional. So I do think that you get... you probably have credences over like infinitely many propositions because you're just disposed to have... You know, if I actually ask you about the proposition, you'll give me an answer. So it's a really boring kind of answer, which is to say, no, the rabbit hole totally exists, and I just try and get away from it by giving you a weird non-psychological account of credences.
I'll take the sidestep. and I'm not sure I'm parsing the question correctly, but I'll give it a go. They say, is information about the resilience captured by a full description of your current credences across the hypothesis space? If not, is there a parsimonious way to convey the extra information about resilience?
Okay, so your current credence across the hypothesis space, I'm trying to think about the best way of parsing that. So like, your credences across the hypothesis in question. So let's imagine that I'm just asking you your credence, say that the intervention has value n for each n that I'm considering. That will not capture the resilience of your credence because it's going to be how you think that's going to adjust in response to a new state. If you include that, how things are going to adjust in response to a new state in your hypothesis space, then yes, that should cover resilience. It just depends on how you're carving up the space.
Okay, and I'd take more questions, but I think we all have to head over to Hall D, so I'm going to thank you for your talk. Thanks so much.